It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Well, this morning it's just Kirk, not Casey. Casey's on vacation. We wish him well. He'll be back next week. We got a lot to cover today, though, and I hope you'll deal with Kirk O'Bear's crazy antics this morning. The big thing that we want to talk about right off the bat, at least in the legal community, this has been a significant development, and I'm sure all of you are aware of the antics of Ken Kratz, the former district attorney of Calumet County. Earlier this week, the Wisconsin Supreme Court issued a disciplinary decision, ultimately coming to the conclusion that Mr. Kratz will lose his law license for a period of 4 months. A little bit of the backstory here. Mr. Kratz was the district attorney in Calumet County. He was involved in a case where he was representing an alleged victim of a crime. He then ended up texting this female victim several saucy text messages and implied, at least without expressly saying so, that there could be a sexual relationship between the two should the woman choose to go down that route. It was investigated by local law enforcement authorities, reported to the Office of Lawyer Regulation. And one feature of the disciplinary decision that ended up becoming quite prominent in the Supreme Court's determination as to what should happen is that Mr. Kratz proposed his own punishment. Now, when I was a kid, I was a fan of the Brady Bunch. I know a lot of you probably were. And there was the episode where Peter was playing ball in the house, and it ended up breaking Mom's vase, Mrs. Brady's vase. There was some finger-pointing, and the conspirators of the alleged incident, that being the other five Brady kids, the investigation into the incident resulted in, ultimately, Peter being the one that denied any involvement. The rest of the kids either tried to take responsibility themselves, falsely, and ultimately ended up pointing the finger at Peter. So when Peter was caught with his pants down, so to speak, he was asked what his own punishment should be. He ended up picking some rewards, so to speak. He decided that his punishment should be that he shouldn't have to do any chores, and that he should be awarded several items that he had been wanting for Christmas. He wanted them early, that sort of thing. And the moral of the story is it's very difficult to pick your own punishment, because if you propose it yourself, it's probably not punishment. And secondly, it doesn't serve the purpose of somebody else deciding what you did was wrong and what the appropriate sanction should be. So Mr. Kratz proposed that he get treatment for his drug addiction and what he termed as a sex addiction, that he apologize publicly, and that he, because of his lengthy and stellar career, that he be allowed to simply move on without any further ado. Now, interestingly enough, the Office of Lawyer Regulation, which is that entity that regulates, as the name suggests, lawyers from imposition of the ethical rules. Now, the ethical rules are determined by the Supreme Court of Wisconsin. All attorneys in the state have to abide by those rules. And when there is a complaint that an attorney has not followed those rules, an investigation ensues, and there is a referee appointed, and then there are recommendations made to the ultimate body of the Supreme Court as to what should happen. All justices on the Supreme Court then determine what the appropriate level of sanction should be. And when we say sanction, of course, we mean penalty. It can range all the way from no sanction, no penalty, up to a permanent loss of one's license to practice law. And the rules that are considered involve not only basic duty to your client, but also things that involve trustworthiness, telling the truth, basically, conducting oneself as an attorney that respectfully portrays the legal profession. And when one engages in conduct that calls any of those attributes into question, that is when the Supreme Court steps in and makes a determination with regard to what the appropriate response should be. This is different and separate from any criminal charges that could be imposed, although there are attorneys that, because of a criminal charge or criminal conviction, end up facing separate punishment from the Supreme Court. So there are attorneys that go to prison, become felons, whatever the case may be, and separate from that, the Supreme Court will determine the appropriate punishment. So what Mr. Kratz did here is that he made his own suggestion as to what the Supreme Court should do. Now, the OLR received that communication from Mr. Kratz, and this was a few years ago, and rejected it. So then the issue came up, they felt that that was not an appropriate level of penalty given what he had done. Now, it winds its way through the court system over the course of years, and Mr. Kratz ends up denying some of the allegations due to either not remembering exactly what happened or just flat out saying it didn't happen. But he did admit to the communications that he made to the female victim in the case. He points out that he recused himself as soon as there was a police investigation. Of course, the Supreme Court points out that, well, that was too little, too late, given the fact that he'd already engaged in the conduct. And in addition, there were reports of District Attorney Kratz making boorish comments to women that either worked in the DA's office or were affiliated in some way with the DA's office through the clerk's office in Calumet County. He made some inappropriate comments regarding the size of a woman's breast. Also made comments about how he'd rather be in Las Vegas with large-breasted women rather than being on the job. And he also made a very disgusting comment regarding a sexual act to one of his coworkers. In his defense, he indicated that that's just the kind of office talk that goes on sometimes. And to some extent, that can be understood. But collectively, the pattern of conduct here is that he was basically running out of control. And in spite of his self-proclaimed attributes as a district attorney and an advocate of victims' rights, he was having some serious mental health and drug-related problems. Now, as it winds its way up to the Supreme Court level, where the Office of Lawyer Regulation ultimately determines that he should lose his law license, and by the way, it's for a period of 4 months. So for 4 months, effective in July, Mr. Kratz will not be permitted for just those 120 days to practice law. At the end of that four-month period, he just gets to practice law again. So if you're thinking about an appropriate penalty when someone betrays the public trust to the extent that an elected official engages in outrageous, reckless, and selfish conduct, what should happen? Oftentimes the public becomes outraged when they learn that it just means that he can't work as an attorney for 120 days. Frankly, not much of a sentence. If any of us were forced in a position where we couldn't work for that period of time due to disability, due to an illness, due to an accident, due to needing time off because you're stressed or you're burning out or whatever the case may be, these are things that happen in life all the time to normal people that haven't done anything wrong. And now we have a situation where, lo and behold, something that became a matter of national interest, national embarrassment, I would even say, as it reflects upon the officials that we trust with the discretion to make those decisions and to advocate for the interests of the people of our state. Now, to make matters worse, Mr. Kratz was in the process of attempting to minimize his responsibility in the process and acted as if he was the best person to determine what the appropriate level of penalty should be given the disputes that arose. a little footnote here, and this is just interesting because the way these things work. When an attorney violates the rules and the Supreme Court finds that to have happened, naturally, the Supreme Court and the referee and the attorneys involved in the process incur costs. And that can mean on the clock. It can mean investigative fees. It can mean hourly fees that relate to hearings that are conducted and so on. Part of the penalty that an attorney may face in these situations is that he or she may have to pay those costs. Well, through the course of this investigation and ultimately the decision that Kratz should lose his license for 4 months, it cost $24,000 in legal fees. And the issue then becomes who's responsible for paying those fees. And Mr. Kratz suggested, not so respectfully, to the Supreme Court that he should not be liable, not responsible for those fees, because remember, way back at the beginning of the story when I told you that he offered to impose his own level of discipline, which essentially was a profound apology, and also he states that he removed himself from the practice of law voluntarily because he entered treatment and was a psychological and apparently drug-addicted and sex-addicted mess for a period of time, that we should just give him credit for that and move on. Well, that's not the way it worked out. So we'll be following the story as developments occur, but it is a significant event in the legal community here in Wisconsin. It is time for a break, and we'll be back right after these messages with more Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Now, big news this week. Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen issued a warning to county clerks throughout the state. This happened on Thursday this week. Warning that prosecutors could charge county clerks with criminal charges for issuing marriage licenses to same-sex couples. As we all know, a federal judge on June 6th issued a ruling that held the provision within the Wisconsin Constitution that was voted upon by the public is unconstitutional. Mr. Van Hollen, who we all know is a Republican, told a Milwaukee Journal Sentinel newspaper that gay couples who have married since U.S. District Court Barbara Crabb issued her ruling last week, they aren't legally married, and district attorneys could opt to charge county clerks who issue them licenses with a crime. Now, Van Hollen said that this is going to be up to individual district attorneys because, as the attorney general, he does not get to make those decisions. But he does point out that there are penalties within our marriage code, within the statutes of our state. And hopefully, he hopes, he's just sending out this warning shot, that the county clerks are acting with full knowledge that there could be legal repercussions for taking the law into their own hands, as he words it. Sheboygan County is one of those counties that began issuing licenses June 6th, just hours after Judge Crabb's ruling came out. As of the report that came out on Thursday this week, 60 of the state's 72 counties are actively issuing licenses. Now, there's been a lot of confusion about what clerks can legally do, or for that matter, what they're legally required to do. Judge Crabb declared the ban unconstitutional but didn't issue any order specifically telling clerks that they had to issue licenses. Van Hollen states that without this type of order, clerks should not be doing so. Now, the interesting thing about this, if you think about the difficult position that a county clerk finds him or herself in, there is a responsibility that we all have, especially those that are in a position as a public official, with a specific duty. One of the duties of the clerk of court's office is to coordinate and issue marriage licenses to those who properly qualify. In the process of doing that, it would be extremely unlawful for a clerk to discriminate in some way that would be unconstitutional. For example, if a license were not issued or refused to a couple that is of mixed race based upon their age or, let's say, disability. If the clerk's office decided that somebody that had a terminal illness is not in a good position to marry somebody else because of whatever difficulties that person may imagine, or let's say an older man, let's just say 80 years old, wants to marry an 18-year-old girl. Well, if the clerk felt that that was not right, even though legal, but not right, it would be extremely dangerous, I would say, for the clerk to take any sort of position of judgment. So, rightfully so, I believe many of the clerks in our state are taking the position that if people have a right to become married, and it's true that our law hasn't changed per se, but it's been declared by a federal judge in our jurisdiction that a procedure whereby a same-sex couple is prohibited from being married is unconstitutional. And public officials do have a duty to not administer their function or their job in such a way that results in unconstitutional discrimination. So from a county clerk's perspective, when there has been a ruling of a court that has proper jurisdiction, that the law as it stands is not constitutional, it clearly makes sense that by allowing those and by issuing those licenses, at least until something else happens, or at least until there's some official declaration as to which way this should go, 'tis better to err on the side of not violating people's constitutional rights. What if we had some rule out there that police officers were told by their superiors, let's say, for example, all the way up the chain to the Attorney General's office, that given a recent ruling in court that a certain practice is unconstitutional, that the police should go ahead and continue with that practice in violating people's constitutional rights? Well, it's a bit of a different context, but I think we can all see that that would be problematic and not consistent with our public policies on these matters. Now, it's come up particularly to a head in Dane County, which most of us consider to be the most liberal county in the state. There's really not much dispute about that. They began issuing licenses almost immediately after Judge Crabb's decision. Judge Crabb is by the way, a federal judge in Madison, which is in the Western District of Wisconsin. There has to be a criminal intent, I would point out, by a county clerk to violate the law with specific intent that they be deliberately violating a statute. Now, how is it that a county clerk could be charged as such? And perhaps that's the reason why we see J.B. Van Hollen issuing this order, as I view it as a political maneuver. And frankly, that's disgusting, because as the Attorney General, the duty of the Attorney General is to enforce the law. It happens occasionally where a law is considered invalid because of the constitutional implications involved. And that's precisely what we have here. So it is not only his duty to enforce the law, but to consider the individual constitutional rights of all people potentially affected by that law. And when there is a decision that is clearly addressing the situation directly on point. We're not talking about speculation about, you know, whether it does or doesn't apply to various different situations. We're talking about a very simple concept here, and that is that same-sex couples cannot be deprived of the right to marry based on the constitutional effect of that form of discrimination. And basically, it goes to our individual rights to be happy, to be free, to lead a life that really is a matter of personal choice. So there was a comment by Janine Geske, who is a Marquette University law professor, and frankly, she is a former Supreme Court justice. She said that charging county clerks would be impractical and expensive. For example, since district attorneys, clerks, and judges in a county likely all know each other, district attorneys would have to call in special prosecutors and judges from outside that county to avoid an appearance of conflict of interest. A conviction would also be difficult to win, since clerks could argue Crabb's decision is unclear and they're interpreting it as best they can. This is what former Justice Geske said. And it is not as if clerks are completely ignoring the basic requirements for marriage licenses, such as a birth certificate. So, you know, while there is no indication as to what clerks should do, I think the principle behind it, that there is a constitutional implication here, is clear. It's just the implementation of this law is unclear. It'd be one thing if Judge Crabb said, I find that prohibiting gay marriage in Wisconsin is unconstitutional. However, I'm directing the clerks not to issue any marriage licenses. And that's not what was said. That's not part of the decision. And that's not part of what's happening here. So Van Hollen isn't seeking re-election this fall, interestingly enough. So I guess we can't really attribute this to any direct political motivation. But there are four candidates that are vying to replace him, including Waukesha County District Attorney Brad Schimmel, who we've covered on this show before, an individual who has a drunk driving conviction on his record. We've discussed whether that disqualifies him or not. But there is also the Dane County District Attorney, Susan Happ, the Jefferson County District Attorney, and State Representative John Richards of Milwaukee, all of which are vying for re-election this fall. Clerks in those counties are all issuing licenses, interestingly enough. Happ said in an email to the Associated Press that she doesn't think any district attorney could justify charges. So this appears to be sort of a hollow threat, in the sense that we can't really imagine that this would be something that actually happens. It's more just a statement that's out there. Where it's coming from, we can only assume it's somewhat politically motivated, although we do understand Van Hollen's not seeking re-election, but certainly is probably supporting somebody with his same political agenda. The campaign spokesman for Richards, who is Sachin Chheda, called the Attorney General's stance outrageous. "There is no need to insert DAs into this process," Chheda said. "He can't win in federal court, so he's threatening clerks. That's the wrong thing to do." Can't agree more. It seems that by having the threat of criminal prosecution based upon what is likely a reasonable interpretation of the clerk's requirement seems to be unjustified. Now, I don't know if we can go this far, but one might also say that threatening specific prosecution, and it would have to be against a particular individual for a particular act, that threat in and of itself could also constitute a criminal charge. If one threatens to prosecute another person due to a motivation or an intent that that person not execute their official duty. Let's say, for example, I am a police chief and I have police officers that work for me, and I threaten that if anybody doesn't respect my ruling that is contrary to the constitutional standards of our state, in other words, my own will, and if I threaten to prosecute any police officer who is unwilling to violate people's constitutional rights, well, I could face prosecution myself if I were to direct those types of orders, because that's interfering with a public official's duty to perform their official function. Well, this is going to really be interesting how this all plays out, and you can bet that we'll be covering it in depth on Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. It's time for another break, but we'll be back with the second half of the show right after this.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL. Bad boys, what you want?
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I hope you're enjoying the show. Now let's get on with the second half of the show. Time just flies by. You know, usually when Casey is here, the banter that goes back and forth makes it so, you know, an hour goes by and you hardly even notice that it's passed. it seems to drag on a little bit more when I'm just sitting here talking to myself and sharing my time with all of you. But trust me, I do enjoy spending Saturday mornings with you, whether it's with Casey or not. But we'll welcome him back next week when he's done with his much-deserved vacation. Big news this week, Sheboygan County cops were suspended without pay for drunk driving. Two off-duty Sheboygan police officers who were convicted of drunk driving last month have since been suspended by the Sheboygan Police Department. Sheboygan Police Chief Christopher Dumlagalski said in a news release Thursday that the suspensions were issued after the officers' cases concluded May 28th in municipal court. One of the officers, Ryan Wallach, who is 25 years old, received a 15-day suspension, while his colleague, Stephen Schnabel, 35, was suspended for 30 days, according to the press release. Municipal court officials on Thursday refused to release information to a Sheboygan Press reporter on the outcome of the officers' cases. We can pretty much guess what that is, because when someone is convicted of first offense drunk driving, that means that they are fined, usually somewhere in the neighborhood of $800 or so. There is a suspension of one's driving privileges between 6 months and 9 months. There's a requirement for an alcohol assessment. There are 6 points assessed on a person's license. And depending upon how much alcohol was detected in the person's system, there may be a requirement for an ignition interlock device to be installed on any vehicle that person operates. So, not much mystery about what happens, because that's really the grand total of the range of options that could have occurred in this case. But notwithstanding that, there has been much talk about the effect of somebody in the position of enforcing the law, breaking the law in this manner. According to Domagowski, the Sheboygan Police Department understands the importance of earning and maintaining the public's trusts. Actions by department members that damage this trust will not be tolerated. The Sheboygan Police Department states they are committed to building strong community relationships and demonstrating trustworthiness on a daily basis. These officers were arrested December 5th after a late-night accident at the corner of Superior Avenue and North Taylor Drive here in Sheboygan. Both were off-duty, thankfully, at the time in their personal vehicles when one driver rear-ended the other at the blinking light. An arrest report showed that Wallach's preliminary blood alcohol concentration was 0.10 and Schnabel's was 0.23, both certainly more than the legal limit of 0.08. Now, interestingly, just a little side note here. When our law changed several years ago to make it so the legal standard is 0.08 rather than 0.10, at least Officer Wallach would have been right on the line that we would have considered to be not drunk, or at least not guilty of an offense involved impaired driving. Now, 0.23, on the other hand, which was Officer Schnabel's alcohol concentration, that is considered to be a rather high result, and one would tend to see obvious signs of impairment at that level, such as stumbling, staggering, slurring speech, not able to control a vehicle. Not so much, or at least not as frequently, when somebody displays a lower alcohol concentration. Now, both officers were, in fact, charged with first offense operating while intoxicated, so there's not a history of this with either person, and that's good. They were placed on administrative duties following the arrest, but were back on active duty several days later, pending an internal investigation. So just to point out here, what happened was an arrest occurred. At the time of the arrest, we knew what the preliminary breath tests were that were taken on the scene, and we knew that both were over the legal limit. Both were presumed to be operating while impaired because of that legal limit finding, and they were placed on desk duty, but later returned back to active duty just within several days because there was an internal investigation. Now, the investigation basically was put on hold pending conclusion of the court cases. Now, interestingly enough, that is an action that we might say gives the benefit of the doubt to the police officers, and in most circumstances I would fully support that. But putting an officer back on full active duty, knowing that there is this pending charge out there, is a little bit of a different story. And we see it pretty frequently where we have somebody who is under investigation and not yet convicted of a matter that causes concern over that person's ability to discharge their official duties, especially when it comes to an alcohol-related or a mental health-related issue that could clearly interfere with that person's effective duty. Now, when we have those situations, the law doesn't say whether we do or don't put that person on administrative leave and so forth. Now, there are requirements under employment law standards and basically internal procedures that dictate how those things are supposed to occur. And the emphasis of those internal procedures traditionally is that if there is some doubt with regard to that officer's ability to discharge his or her duties, then again, you err on the side of caution because these are people that are trusted with not only enforcing the law in a even-handed, correct manner, but also to display their own respect for the law, so to speak. Now, we get into very difficult territory here. We're all familiar with how complicated and difficult dealing with, and we refer to them generally as addiction-oriented issues, but another way of putting it would be substance abuse. And substance abuse can occur in all kinds of different levels. I mean, normally we think that it means something like illegal drugs or something like that. It can also include prescription medication and probably the worst drug that we have in our society that is abused on a daily basis by many, many people and tolerated, frankly, is alcohol abuse. And one of the things that's most insidious about alcohol abuse is that it's one of those situations where people don't necessarily understand that what they're doing is against the law. And that's this conundrum that we find ourselves in. We trust people to operate these missiles on the road that weigh, sometimes they weigh a ton. And you're guiding the missile under circumstances where we hope you're not going to use it to kill somebody or yourself. And that responsibility to operate a piece of heavy machinery is one that we obviously take very seriously. However, you combine that with the fact that when one consumes alcohol and impairment begins to set in, it's normal and it's actually more common than people might realize that a person becomes less and less aware of their own level of impairment. Alcohol also causes, as we all know, impaired judgment. So one assessing their own level of impairment and trying to determine whether or not they've had too much to drink, the problem with alcohol is that you're not as good at making that assessment against yourself as more drinks are consumed. So legally speaking, it's one of those odd laws. We all know that drunk driving is bad and that people shouldn't be drinking and driving and all that. But the law also permits people to consume some alcohol and then drive. There's nothing illegal about that. It has to be to the point where it's impairing that individual. And it's up to, when you talk about the duty to follow the law, each individual has to know what their limit is, and that's based in part on their own perception of their level of impairment. So it's basically a vicious circle because the law expects you to be have good judgment and the steady hand necessary to safely operate a motor vehicle. Yet we all know that alcohol makes it more difficult to do that. So we expect people to conform their behavior to the law, knowing that the consumption of alcohol makes it that much harder to do it. In some cases, impossible. There are times when someone's consumed so much alcohol that they're not even aware of where they are or what they're doing or what planet they're on. And interestingly enough, our law, of course, provides that type of behavior is illegal. What it really comes down to is that we each have to determine whether or not we are the type of person that has good judgment beforehand and can plan ahead of times. So you have to know before you've even had your first drink that you're not going to drive. But again, as it's perfectly legal for people to consume some alcohol and then drive, we then are asking people to make a determination after impairment begins to set in and to be aware of the fact that there's too much impairment to be behind the wheel. It's been suggested, and I can't say that this is necessarily a bad idea, but Mothers Against Drunk Driving, which has been a long-running organization throughout the country, has proposed that not only do we utilize ignition interlock devices, and for those of you that aren't familiar with this, it's a machine, basically. It's about the size of a cell phone that gets attached to your ignition system. You have to blow into the machine in order to start the car, and then at random intervals to make sure that you're continuing to have no alcohol in your system. Mothers Against Drunk Driving have proposed that sometime in the not-too-distant future, perhaps all vehicles that are operated within the United States will automatically be equipped with these devices. Would that be something? We talked about it before in the show. Would that be something that would save lives? Certainly. Would it be something that people would object to because of the cost involved and because of the restraint or perceived restraint on our freedoms? Yes, there would be that too. But that's something that I'm sure within the next 5 years we're going to see some sort of development. We've already seen a big push to have those people that are involved with drunk driving situations install these devices, and we're still in the more or less the infancy of that period because it's only been in effect now for a few years, less than 3 years, to see how people will comply with those requirements and whether or not it reduces recidivism or repeat offenders. So we'll continue to cover this topic along with all other items of legal interest to our community. We're going to have to take a break, but we'll be back for the final segment right after this.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And we're back with Legal Defense. I'm Kirk Colbert. Now, we've got an interesting story here about an individual who was recently charged with a dine and dash scheme. You know what dining and dashing is? It means you dine and then you leave without paying. Generally regarded as against the law, rightfully so, because you're stealing, right? That's what it's all about. So this guy, it was reported recently, earlier this week as a matter of fact, that an individual was going through the process of repeatedly going to a restaurant, eating his meal, and then having a seizure that he faked. And one might think, okay, that's kind of slimy, and I don't know if any of you have ever engaged in a dine and dash, but the guy should get some credit for originality, okay? Maybe a little, I don't know. But it is a form of stealing, let's face it. Now, the interesting thing about this case is that the guy had done it many, many times, and there was a pattern that was established, and of course, it was determined by medical personnel along the way that the person had not, in fact, suffered a seizure. So, interesting footnote to this story, the man was sentenced to 3 years in prison, being confined because of a repeat pattern of behavior. And for those of you that are thinking about going to Pizza Hut, ordering your pizza, eating, and then having a fake trip to the bathroom, don't do it because you might go to prison, especially if you fake a seizure and do it. That's the lesson learned. Another interesting story. A man drove over 1,900 miles with his girlfriend's corpse in the car. A Michigan man drove 1,900 miles with his girlfriend's dead body in the passenger seat and didn't report it to anybody that she had died. His name is Ray Tomlinson, 62 years old, and his mother, 93 years old, had picked up Tomlinson's 31-year-old girlfriend from a mental health facility in Arizona and began the long drive home to Detroit. There's only one problem with all of this. She died at some point, some unknown point, during the trip. Now, doesn't this remind you of, what was it, National Lampoon's Vacation, where a family member ends up dying and they're not sure exactly what to do. They're in the middle of the trip. Well, anyway, Tomlinson kept on driving, planning to drop off the dead body at some point once they returned home to Michigan. But while they were driving through the Southwest, Tomlinson discovered that his girlfriend was stone cold dead in the seat next to him. But instead of calling the police, he used his smartphone to look up what to do with a corpse. Hey, you know, Google's there for a reason. If you don't know what to do with a corpse, just Google it, right? That's probably what I would do. But even stranger, the police were alerted to the incident after Tomlinson answered a call on his dead girlfriend's cell phone from the mental health facility that she'd been picked up at. According to Detroit's WWJ-TV, Tomlinson told the facility that his girlfriend couldn't make any future appointments since she was dead. The facility then said, "Hey, Mr. Tomlinson, it would be a good idea, and we would strongly suggest that you call 911. Which he did, and then there was the question of when and how are you supposed to report discovering a dead body? Various states have different laws regarding the handling and care of corpses. In Wisconsin, we have a law that says you can't abuse a corpse, and you must report finding a corpse. However, police found no signs of foul play in the autopsy that was performed, and they suspected that she may have overdosed on oxycodone. Michigan law specifically prohibits mutilating or conveying away human bodies from the place that they may be interred. Not, that generally means grave robbing. But action or inaction in this case doesn't really seem to fit the statute, and officials in Michigan decided that they would not charge him with any offense. Interesting story, though, because Tomlinson told the Detroit Free Press that he decided to keep driving to Michigan because he had his elderly mother in the van and she doesn't travel well. Traveling with a decomposing corpse in the front passenger seat, I can't imagine is all that convenient, but nonetheless, that's what happened. Surprisingly, Tomlinson isn't the first person to quote-unquote, innocently keep a corpse in his car. There was a Southern California real estate agent who once kept a homeless woman corpse in her car for months because he was afraid to tell anybody that the woman had died in his car. Now imagine the new car scent that you'd have to use and how many bottles of it you'd need in that situation. Ugh, just can't fathom it. And also, I can't help but make the reference to Weekend at Bernie's. Remember that movie where you know, Bernie, the guy, dies, and they basically keep him around for days and days, which, by the way, forensically is not very accurate because, as you notice, throughout the course of the movie, which takes place over the course of several days, you know, the dead Bernie guy ends up still having flexibility in his limbs, doesn't exhibit rigor mortis, and apparently nobody seems to notice the distinct odor that a decomposing corpse starts to emit very shortly after death. Well, interesting. But there has been another story in the news that broke recently regarding the two 12-year-old girls that are currently being charged as adults in state court regarding their attempted murder of another friend of theirs based upon what appears to be a belief that Slender Man, the fictitious character that is the subject of some websites and I believe even some games that can be played. And the big controversy there relates to whether or not a child, which we, a 12-year-old is a child under the law, can or should be charged as an adult when we have one of those situations where a very serious crime with intent has been committed. And the thing that's been so controversial in this area of the law is that we don't consider juveniles, anybody under the age of 18, to be legally responsible for their own decisions as it relates to several different things. One is that we don't trust them to vote because we don't think they are mature enough to take responsibility for that decision. We don't allow people under the age of 18, or for that matter, under the age of 21, to drink alcohol because they are not mature enough to take responsibility for their own actions. We don't allow people that are under the age of 18 to smoke cigarettes because, again, we don't trust somebody that lacks that maturity to have the foresight and good judgment to be able to make those own determinations, and it does corrupt a person's ability to have a healthy future, etc., etc. A corollary of this understanding is that somebody who is underage doesn't have the legal capability to form intent. The most commonly cited example is when there is a sexual relationship between somebody under the age of 18 or under the age of 16 or under the age of 13. and those are different levels of offense depending upon how young the person is. But in any of those scenarios, even if the alleged quote-unquote victim fully and consciously consents in a realistic sense, but not in a legal sense, we deem that person to be unable to form that mental intent. Yet at the same time, when we have a 12-year-old or two 12-year-olds in this situation who are charged with a very serious crime that any adult would be facing very serious consequences, we say that's serious enough that we should ignore the aspects of law that otherwise mandate that this person not be deemed legally capable of making their own decisions. Well, here's an interesting corollary to the story. There was a boy in Russia, and I know this isn't a local story, but it has local interest because of our case that's pending right now with the two 12-year-olds. The question becomes, when does a boy become a man in the eyes of the law? And in Russia, it apparently depends at least partially on the size of someone's genitals. And yes, you heard me right. In Russia, there was a boy suspected of theft whose family claims he's only 13 years old, set to be tried as an adult after an examination of his teeth and genitals led doctors to believe that he's actually between 16 and 17, despite the official records of his correct age and the statement of his relatives that he is only 13 years old. In general, juvenile courts can transfer cases from juvenile court system to the adult criminal court system by way of a process called juvenile waiver, and that's what we've seen in this case here in Wisconsin. Juvenile waiver is available in all states except New York, Nebraska, and New Mexico, though the age of juvenile offenders eligible for waiver varies from state to state. Another aspect of our law is that it's one of the things that states individually determine. The decision to try a juvenile as an adult is generally at the discretion of the judge, but some states have provisions which exclude certain types of crime, such as first-degree murder, from juvenile courts altogether. Now, even when tried as adults, however, these limits to the sentences can be imposed. There are limits to the sentences that can be imposed on juvenile offenders. In 2005, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the execution of a man for a murder committed when he was 17 constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in light of the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. So, as for the teenager in Russia, the case is now under review within the Russian court system, but imagine if the legal standard by which one may or may not be facing criminal prosecution has to do with the maturity of one's private parts. That would be an interesting process whereby we'd have to wonder what role the court really plays in that process. Well, another interesting story that came out of Missouri this week, an ex-police officer was busted for making hidden camera bathroom videos and loading them onto a pornography site. A Missouri police officer was accused of recording hidden camera bathroom videos of men using the bathroom. And I'm going to say this wasn't number one. This was the number two version of using the bathroom. David Cherna, 33, who's been relieved of duty since his arrest, will face a Clayton, Missouri grand jury in July on invasion of privacy charges for his alleged hidden camera bathroom antics. So this alleged filming enterprise was uncovered by an investigative reporter who tipped off local police that someone was secretly filming men using the bathroom at a gas station in Chesterfield, Missouri. What police didn't suspect was their investigation would lead to the arrest of then-officer Cherna. He was an active police officer at the time of this event. We'll have to see how this unfolds in the future, but, you know, when legal news breaks, sometimes it's just darn weird, and here is a perfect example. So I'm afraid we're at the end of our time, but we'll talk to you again next week as we do every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 here on 1330 WHBL. This has been Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Have a good weekend.